morning. We'll be starting the class momentarily. Today we'll have more of an informal discussion. And just for confirmation, once you hear the audio feed online, if you're listening online, please just type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. That'll confirm that you're picking up the feed properly. Good morning, Doug. Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Doing all right, thank God. How are you guys doing?
Very good, thank you. Cal okay, will be here in just a moment. Sean's with us, too.
Okay, good. I had a few things I was looking over. Nothing that I had specific, the two possibilities, but I'll start by seeing if there are any questions, anything that came up this week from your end.
I think there's one rattling around in my head. Give me just a second to formulate.
Sure, sure. Go ahead. We'll wait till Cal gets onto it.
Okay. I think I wanted to clarify around the idea of idolatry based on Rabbi Chait's tapes that blasphemy is, if I use the euphemism blessing for cursing, blessing the Creator, and that you had to use the Creator as both the object and the subject, or the both parts of the curse, so that if you were using the name, as the Talmud says, Josi, that it has to be of the form, may Josi destroy Josi, but that the common uses of people being G-damn this or G-damn that or whatever are not considered halakhic blasphemy, although it's certainly not a very good idea to get in the habit of doing that. Is that correct?
I don't have fluency in that area, so I can't answer you. I did see some Gemaras on that, just some portions of the Talmud on that, but that's not something which I'm well-versed in enough at all to respond to.
Okay.
But I do recall where you're referring to.
I just probably need to go back and listen to his explanation again on that.
Did he give that in the Nochai tapes or the classes that he gave you, or is it something he did on the idolatry?
These were a series of classes he gave many years ago to a Nochai group in Athens, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And they're out on the part of the YBT library. There's about, I think, 90 or 100 of them. He gave them once a week on Wednesday nights for an hour. And covered a whole variety of topics kind of aimed at Noahides. A real rich treasury of information.
Yeah, I personally went through, I think, about 32 of those that somebody had sent me, who was one of the Noahides had sent me. CD. I posted them on the Masorah site. I don't recall that topic, though, in terms of the halacha on the blasphemy, though. That may have been part of the other menu. If you're saying there were about 100 tapes, so it's quite a few that I had not gone through.
Yeah, there's a lot of the potential study there available.
We'll have to get a hold of those. Those are all of them on the YBT site?
Yes, they're not available as audio classes, but they're available for purchase.
Uh-huh. I'll have to look into that. See if
There was something in this week's Parsha that I found troubling as well. And Cal's about to grab that on my behalf that I wouldn't mind kicking around a little bit if we can.
Sure.
Okay. The thing I did not understand Yeah. It's when Rachel's not having children.
Right.
And so I recognize that having children was incredibly important in those days, and it still is, but I think perhaps even more so then. And so she finally says to Jacob, you know, here's my maid Bilhah. Consort with her that she may bear upon my knees, and I too may be built up through her. And Leah does the same thing, of course, with her handmaid. And I scratched my head and I said, okay, I just don't get this. I've got a servant. I'm not having kids. So I'll turn around and give my servant to my husband as a wife, which makes her on equal status with me. And maybe she'll have kids, and somehow that means I've had kids through her, or, I mean, somehow Rachel and Leah are getting that they get to have kids vicariously somehow, and that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, why the fact that they're their handmaids, and even if they are, then, I mean, why not, you know, why doesn't Rachel turn to Leah and say, well, you have more kids? I mean, she's certainly got a closer relationship, I would think, to her sister than she does to her servant. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but that whole thing just did not make sense to me.
Right. Well, the first time this happened was with Sarah. So this was not the first time that this took place, that the wife gave her handmaid to her husband. That was in Genesis 15:1. It says there that Sarai was her name at that point, the wife of Abraham, had not given birth to him. And she had an Egyptian handmaid, and her name was Hagar. And Sarah said to Abram, behold, God has held me back from giving birth. Please come now unto my maidservant. Perhaps I'll be built up through her. And Abraham listened. And Rashi says something which is a little enigmatic, because we don't know what it means. Rashi says, what does it mean that she'll be built up from her? So Rashi says, with the merit that I entered my opponent into my house, that's the merit that I'll be built up. Now, built up means that it's a, like you said, vicarious, that, or does that mean that eventually that will allow me to have children myself? Or perhaps it means that she'll just be contributing to, you know, Sarah's contributing to the building up the house. But she doesn't say that I will become pregnant from it. She says perhaps I will be built up from her.
Well, it's more like she's relating it to the sacrifice that she's making?
Well, the question is, what is she expecting to happen?
Yeah.
Is she expecting that she'll become pregnant from it? It doesn't say that. That I will become pregnant from this. Perhaps I will be. She says, perhaps I'll become built up.
And I guess the question I have, I don't know how far back it goes, but isn't it where if they haven't had children in 10 years, then the husband, is it obligated or can divorce?
It seems to be, from my recollection, 10 years after they lived in the land of Israel. So then he would be obligated to divorce and to have, because he has an obligation to have children. The man has the obligation to have children.
So could having a handmaiden children can be built up to her, can that sort of substitute for that?
Either that, or by the fact that she recognizes that the child is the important thing and not that I am the mother of the child. That if she demonstrates that, because you can't make a game out of it, meaning they have a thing where people say if you have some, you have a need, that's actually the rabbi say this, Rashi quotes this, and says that anybody who has a need for something and his friend has a need for the same thing, if he prays for his friend, then he is answered first. So if I have a need for money, my friend has a need for money, then I pray that my friend earns money, I'll receive success first. So that can very easily be taken to be like a game where a person really wants it for himself, but the only way he's got to do it is by doing this type of a game with his mind where he's saying that I'll pray for my friend because that's what the rabbi said, and I'll get it. But then he's not really doing it for the right reasons. What the rabbis are saying that if I pray for my friend, it'll happen to me first. That means if I have an objective view about the need for a livelihood. So that means I'm no better than somebody else. I recognize complete equality between all human beings, and I see that somebody else is also troubled by the same need. But I look at that other person as being on par and with me, and I don't put myself first. I recognize that they have the need. So that means I'm expressing an objectivity regarding the human need for something. Now, since I have an objectivity about this, that really shows I have a more of a healthy outlook regarding it. It's not that I am first. It's that this person, if it's me in this case, I'm praying for my friend to have money, so I have a proper attachment to money. And since that's the case, I would then be more entitled to the money than my friend. That's what the rabbis are saying. It's not a game where I really want it, but I know I have to go through the motions of praying for my friend, and that'll ensure it for me. Then that's wrong. Then it's still the person is still the same selfish person that he was. But if a person really as a high-level person, has concern for others and looks at others as being on par with him, so he will not put himself first. He'll pray for another person. That means he has a proper attachment to it. And since he has a proper attachment, then he will get it. This is exactly what God said to King Solomon when he became king at 12 years old. And God came to him in a vision and said, Sholem Atein Lach, ask what I can do for you. So he asked for wisdom to judge the people. So what God said back to him was, since you didn't ask for wealth or the death of your enemies, but you asked for this, I'm now giving you all three. Meaning to say that since King Solomon did not have an attachment to money or a strong emotion of vengeance to wipe out the enemies, but his real objective was attachment to the people, to teach them properly. He saw he was very young, and this is why precisely God came to him in a vision. He was only 12 at this point. So God gave him a tremendous, it was the only time this ever happened, that he advanced his wisdom to tremendous heights overnight. Normally, wisdom is only obtained through diligence and study and years of patience, dedication. But as a young king, there was necessity for him to have wisdom to run the people, and this is what his father King David raised him properly. And so God was saying that since you have the right attachment to the money and to wealth and to your enemies, so and you didn't ask for that as a ends in itself. So now you can have those as well. So it's the same idea, that when the person realizes that this is something that another person has a need for, and they do not look at themselves as any more important, then since this person has the right outlook, they deserve to have it more than others because they will then relate to it properly. It will help their perfection. So that's what it means. If a person has some need and you have the same need, and you pray for them, so you get it first because you are now demonstrating the proper attachment to that need. And then perhaps that might be the case here, that Sarah did not look at herself as having to be the one to bear children for Abraham. She just wanted now at this point that Abraham should have offspring, and they could now, you know, take the mantle and continue and proliferate the ideas of Abraham. And her words that perhaps I'll be built up, it could mean on one level, one meaning, that it'll be my contribution to building the household. But if you say that I'm giving Hagar, and this way I will then get children, that would still sound like, you know, the more selfish approach. So it's just another way to satisfy the selfishness. But it would seem more of a praise to Sarah that she recognized that this was important and did not look at herself as having to be the one to be the one to bear children to Abraham. And you see that all the matriarchs were barren. Even Leah, it says in this week's Parsha, that God had to open up her womb when he saw that she was hated. So then he opened up, it says right away that he opened up her womb. So that means all of them were barren. Evidently, God made it this way that he wanted the mothers of the tribes of Israel, you know, starting with Sarah and Rebekah and Rachel and Leah, that they should all contemplate the concept of motherhood and go through these many years without having children, to reflect and to refine their natures and their character. Of course, this would then perfect them, and then the children would benefit as well. But just to have the natural attachment to a child is not sufficient for these, you know, these matriarchs that they're going to, you know, start the whole nation. But again, it's not clear from Rashi what it means that I will be built up. But if we wanted to be careful of the words, which of course we always should be, she says that perhaps I'll be built up. Sarah does not say perhaps I will give birth because I'm giving this child.
Does Rashi have any commentary? I don't have my Rashi. Well, I should grab my Rashi. I think it's in another room. I was wondering on the section with regard to Rachel.
All right, let's take a look.
Just 30, verse 3.
33. Okay. You do see an interesting thing, though, that in 30 verse 2, after Rachel says to Jacob, says, give me children, if not, I am like a dead person. That's 31. In 32, that's chapter 30 verse 2, Jacob was very angry with Rachel. And he said, am I in God's place that I have held you back from having fruit of the womb? So, but she looked at herself as being dead, as being worthless, not having children. And she says in 3, she says back to Jacob, here is my handmaid Bilhah, go unto her and have intercourse with her, and she'll become pregnant on my knees, and I will be built up also myself through her. So it seems to be just the fact that her maidservant has a child, that is the building up. So it is something which she is contributing to, in a sense that she is contributing to the offspring. So it seems to be the simplest explanation that she's not expecting to become pregnant through giving the handmaid, which would also follow through well with the words by Sarah.
And I see that Rashi comments in 30 verse 3, the part about upon my knees.
Right.
right, Onkelos renders that I will raise the children she will bear. So maybe she's seeing that as an opportunity to have influence on her sons or children in general.
Yeah, he actually brings down right after that. I will be built up. What do you mean, also? What does it mean that Sarah says, also, I will be built up? That's like including something else. So Rashi says, what does it mean, also? So Amr, she said to Jacob, Zekinecha, your grandfather, Abraham, he had children from Hagar. All right. V'chiger masnav keneged Sarah. I guess it means that he was built up in contrast to Sarah, or with Sarah. But now the last part of Rashi seems to be the opposite. So Amar Lo. So Yaakov said, Jacob said back to Rachel here, after she said this, my grandfather entered his opponent, or maybe my grandmother. Yeah, it has to be grandmother. Entered into the equation, her opponent, meaning her maidservant, Hagar, into her house. And she said, Amar Lo, so she said back to him, meaning Rachel said back to Jacob, if this is so, that this is what prevents one from having birth, Hine Amasi, so here is my maidservant. That sounds like she's trying to have children herself by doing this. So either way, but what? Why would that? According to that view, that she really felt that giving the handmaid would be a way for her to become pregnant herself. How does that work?
And I'm reading this. Okay, my grandmother brought her rival wife into her house. She said to him, "If this thing is preventing my bearing children, what is this thing that's preventing? The idea that I won't share my husband with somebody else? Because I wouldn't think that that would be an expected thing one would have to do."
Right. Meaning, if holding back children, if not giving her, is going to prevent, so then I will give my maidservant to my husband. Seems to be like if having the selfish motive of the child myself is, if that's something which is wrong, then I will, and that's holding me back from having a child. So maybe by letting somebody else have a child with Abraham and not holding him back from children, that will in some way allow me too to have children. And what does Rashi say? That perhaps I'll be built up through her. What does Rashi say on this? Like Sarah. So that would seem to be that since Sarah had a child, so it seems to be from Rashi that is the motive, that Rachel saw that by that when Sarah gave Hagar, she ended up having a child, so Rachel felt the same. So I'll give my maidservant Bilhah, and I'll be built up just like Sarah. I will eventually have children just like Sarah. I mean, I will not take this as a that I'm solely responsible to give the children to Jacob, just like Sarah didn't feel solely responsible to give children to Abraham. So she removed, she became more objective in terms of the idea of children.
Okay, but then now that sounds just like what we were talking about with regard to the money. And it sounds like she's doing it with the goal of, so if I let my maidservant in there to have children with Abraham, then maybe I'll get to have children. Kind of like, well, if I pray for my friend to get the money, then maybe I'll get the money.
Right, but I guess the, in her case, the reason why it was a good was she really did perfect herself. She wasn't, it wasn't a game. I mean, a person can really use that method to perfect himself. If a person can really forego being, because here there was with the money, it's a little bit different, because there, I'm not losing anything by praying for somebody else. But here, once she says, let my husband sleep with somebody else and have children, so now that completely removes the aspect of my being the sole mother. Because now somebody else is going to be a mother to Jacob's children. And there's no reversing that. So she is biting the bullet. She is really sacrificing something here. She's letting another woman who's her maidservant, first of all, sleep with her husband, allowing that union, and also allowing there to be a child that her maidservant is going to have that she's not going to have. And you know, there isn't the clear knowledge, there's no proof that this will do anything for her. So what she is doing a real thing here. It's not like where, because you know, like you're saying, it could be that she still has the selfish motive, and I'll get children this way, but there still is something she's giving up now. She now did share children. There's no, it's not the exact parallel to the case where I need money, so I'll just pray for my friend, and then by doing that, I'll end up with the money. So now I'm getting exactly what I plan to get. So that's a game. But here, she's not going to end up with what she exactly wanted. She's not going to be the exclusive mother anymore, because now there's somebody else who had a child with Jacob. So that's a real sacrifice.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah, there's a difference. It does seem, though, that the lesson is that the attachment to the children had to be something which was refined before God would allow the matriarchs to have children. I mean, Sarah, for 90 years, didn't have a child, though. Everybody else had children. I mean, those must have been, you know, again, they were different people than us, so we can't project our emotions onto them and say she must be devastated and this and that. I'm sure she was much higher, she definitely was. She was a prophetess. So her relationship, but you know, she definitely did still have human emotion. So we can't say that she was unhappy. See, even Rachel said, if I don't have children, I'm like a dead person. Her mistake was approaching Jacob. Right.
I noticed that, he gets after her about it, but then he's criticized, I believe, for being insensitive to her.
Where is he criticized?
Note in the Stone Edition of the Summary says, the sages say that God took Jacob to task for his insensitivity to Rachel. And they're quoting Ram Nachmanides.
Yeah. Nachmanides, let's see.
Thank you.
sure where it is.
Yeah, I'm looking in Nachmanides on 30 verse 1, where he says, "The Holy One, blessed be He, said to Jacob, is this the way to answer a woman who is oppressed by her barrenness? By your life, your children are destined to stand before her son Joseph."
Mm-hmm. Oh, there it is. So what does that mean? What type of response is that? They should have to stand before Joseph and need him for food in Egypt.
Sorry, say again?
What does this mean? That they have to stand before Joseph. What aspect of standing before Joseph? So they stood before him for food. They also stood before him, and he worked on their perfection. He, you know, construed that whole that fabrication that Benjamin stole the cup in order to put them in the exact same situation where, again, one of their brothers was their lives was at stake, and would the brothers stand up or would they let him go just like they sold Joseph, just like this, you know, years earlier. That's what Joseph had done. He reenacted the entire case where all the brothers had the ability to either abandon Benjamin or to do a complete repentance and to sacrifice themselves, which they didn't do by Joseph earlier when they sold him. So when they were standing before him, I was wondering what the Ramban is getting at. I mean, what's the, if it's really Jacob's problem, he did something wrong by being harsh with his wife, so what? Why did the sons have to pay the price?
Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense, and I'm also wondering what Nachmanides' source is for this.
Yeah. But, you know, just taking him on his word, he could be saying that it's the same character, that there was a certain amount of distance that that Jacob expressed by not being completely sensitive. So the sons also had that by the fact that they could sell Joseph. So that means that Jacob's flaw is now something which is the sons emulated, and that had to be that brought out the meaning. It's something which Ramban is saying is the correct response. Why is it the correct response? Because then it awakens Jacob to this character trait. And you see that the children also, if they eventually had sold Joseph, they had to stand before him, it was all due to the fact that they had sold him, that there was a certain amount of insensitivity to Joseph. And Jacob would then recognize that and maybe reflect and see that he had this also to Rachel. So, of course, the sons had to do something wrong in order to be standing before Joseph. They're not going to get punished for the father's sins. But Ramban is maybe just saying that the trait maybe is echoed, and he's trying to hint at the fact that this trait that you had, Jacob, is something that you have to correct, and you'll see it, and your sons also have this, of their own doing, of course. But by them standing before Rachel's son, Joseph, it should call to your mind this event right now where you weren't that sensitive. There's a parallel. Ramban is trying to say there's a parallel that Jacob will have to face later on. Hopefully, and it'll be a corrective measure. He'll see his sons now going down, and they're standing before Joseph. Why? He'll finally find out that they were insensitive to Joseph and sold him to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. And he'll think about that, and then maybe reflect on his own insensitivity towards Rachel. Do you hear it?
Yes.
Yeah. Could be a possibility of what he's getting at.
Yeah. Very interesting how much is contained in that one little very brief dialogue.
Yeah. It also struck me that just in general, that the fact that the patriarchs had children that were older, it could be that's also a plan of God, because a person that's older is much wiser, and then the child that he will raise will be that much more perfected than if a young man raises a child. So perhaps that was part of God's plan too, that the Abraham and Sarah shouldn't have children till they're older. And Yitzchak was over 40, and Jacob was 84 when he married Rachel and Leah.
I know. Let's see. Mike, are the commentators, do you know, clear about the age of Rachel and Leah when Yaakov married them?
I did not see age is mentioned by them.
So I thought there was this issue that Rachel was maybe really, really young when
Rebecca.
I'm confusing the two.
Yeah, Rebecca said was very young.
Yeah.
Rashi says that she was 3, but Isaac waited 10 years until she was able to conceive before he had relations. So it's a very different type of a human being. It doesn't seem, though, because when Eliezer came and he said that, you know, we should travel and go back, and Lavan and his father, Suel, they said, well, let's ask the girl herself what she wants to do. So you wouldn't be asking that to a 3-year-old. It seemed to be, maybe there's some other meeting there that she was that young.
Yeah, the other thing about being a 3-year-old is that she watered all those camels, which seems a little bit beyond the physical capability of a 3-year-old.
Right. Right. Yeah, and again, a lot of these have to be investigated. You know, where they're basing on, if there's any Talmud on it. Because Rashi will bring something in. The question is, what's the idea? Is he, in 9 out of 10 times, Rashi is quoting a source. It's not his own writing. Yeah, but the children was really, that was really the focal point. Sarah was also very concerned that Ishmael would be playing with Isaac, and God told Abraham to listen to his wife on this, that she had had greater insight. So it was a difficult thing for Abraham, but he did it. He sent Hagar away with Ishmael, but Sarah evidently saw something that would have been destructive towards Isaac.
A little bit of an aside question. The Abraham sends Hagar away. A sort of surface reading of the text suggests that he sent her out in the desert with a little bit of water, and it's desert out there, and gee, it was practically a death sentence. Hard to imagine that Abraham would have done that. Was there a presumption by the commentators that, you know, he expected her to be able to find another city or get to somewhere safe?
Yeah, I would think for sure. He was not trying to... Nobody says that he was trying to sentence her to a death sentence.
Yeah,
I got the impression that he allotted enough water for her to make it to somewhere.
Well, right, and we read something that the son had a fever and that maybe that's how the water ended up being consumed early.
Uh-huh.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I had a question about earlier in the conversation you mentioned about how Leah was hated. And that term always surprised me because I never associated that with Jacob.
Right. It doesn't say that Jacob hated her. It says, that's 29:31. God saw that Leah was hated, and snua, which means hated, it's definitely the word for hate. Let's see. It's one verse. God saw that Leah was hated, and he opened up her womb. But Rachel was barren. So God did not assist her at that point. But it's in the same verse. Let's see. See, in 30, though, it says, after Laban had given Rachel, after the party of 7 days, he gave Rachel, and of course, Jacob had to continue another 7 years, and it says in 30 that he came unto Rachel, and he loved her, v'yehav gam es Rachel, and he also loved Rachel. Now, what do you mean also loved Rachel? That means he must have loved Leah. And it even says it, the Yehav Gamas Rachel Mileh, he loved Rachel more than Leah. So that teaches us the opposite, that Jacob did love Leah, but there was a greater attachment to Rachel. Nonetheless, God saw that Leah was snua. The meaning snua here would seem to imply less loved. The lesser of the two. So that's considered a dislike, a hate. So the verse clearly says that he loved both.
The way we would use the term is, but more of a comparison of she was loved less than Rachel.
Right, because the verse clearly says that Jacob came to Rachel and he loved her also. V'yehav gam es Rachel. He also loved Rachel more than Leah. But that itself is a pain for Leah. So that could just be describing her perception. If Leah sees that Rachel is more loved, so she views herself as being hated, even though there's love that's going her way too. But there's a competition there. There's a competitive emotion. And it seems to be God did an act of mercy to her, but it didn't really help. She kept on naming the children after her hopes that Jacob would love her, until finally the fourth child. She just thanked God for the child, and that was it. She didn't use the child as a tool of trying to gain Jacob's love. Because she says the first son, Reuben, means that God has seen my affliction. Now my husband will love me. Now that I have a child, my husband will love me. So you see, she was really desperate for his love. Second one also, God has seen that I am hated. So you see, it's her perception. Shimon means that the second one, Simon, means that God has listened to me. And the third one, my husband will accompany me. And by the fourth one, she finally just thanked God. It had nothing to do with the husband anymore.
I guess it seems kind of strange to me because it was laid out from the very beginning how much Jacob loved Rachel. And the whole switch and everything, it just seems like there was an understanding there. So I guess I would think, how could she expect anything more? in fact, it seems like she would be a constant reminder of that sort of double cross or switch that happened. And the fact that she was loved by Jacob, that is more of an testament to his character, because that could be a reminder of being double-crossed.
Oh, you mean that Jacob had that reaction to Leah because he was crossed?
Yes, but it appears that he didn't.
Yeah. Again, like Rabbi Chait said, we have to, when we look at these people, we have to really recognize that they are functioning on a completely different plane than us. There's something which we might interpret as just being like a bickering or a competition. You know, the words really have to be studied to really derive what the lessons are. God's not just recording, you know, typical human emotion over here that you can see every day. There has to be a great lesson. Even, you know, in terms of the character of these people. That's why all this is being recorded. But nonetheless, they are human.
Right, and I wonder if this is a lesson in the danger of comparison. That, you know, how powerful it can be on the influence on our emotions, and to just stay away from it. Because if even the matriarchs are influenced by it, then it has a power.
Yeah, I remember Chait saying also once that none of the patriarchs ever took a second wife without the permission of the first. I mean, that wasn't something that was their way. You know, having a wife and children, that was it. There wasn't, the multiplicity of wives was not really part of what their outlook was. The wives suggested it. You know, Sarah suggested it to Abraham, and Leah and Rachel both suggested it to Jacob. And you see, of course, Isaac only had one wife. And Jacob as well. I mean, Joseph. So the type of relationship that they had in terms of marriage in their lives is something, you know, to study and to see, you know, lessons from. But also at the same time, it's not to be looked at that in the same way that we have today. And you see King Solomon also, all those wives that removed him from God. And even though he didn't build any altars for idolatry, you know, the prophets it describes it to him because he didn't prevent one of his wives from that activity, building altars to alien gods. But he went against the warning of the Torah not to increase wives. He felt it wouldn't affect him, but it did.
That's 18 for the king, wasn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Seems an amazing thing that a man of Solomon's wisdom would directly violate, well, the 18 is one of the 613, in other words, it's a Torah commandment?
It says by the king that he shouldn't increase his wives.
Oh, do we know who defined it to be 18?
I don't know offhand. I'm not sure if that's just the king or if anybody. I mean, there was eventually a rabbinic decree. Rabbeinu Gershom, much later on, had decreed that a man should just marry one woman. I'm not sure the backdrop to that, though.
Okay.
But, you know, you look at all the years, for 100 years, you know, Abraham was, he was married to Sarah. That was it, Sarah. There was no, I mean, it's definitely showing you that is, you know, Adam and Eve, same thing. But then you say there, that there was only one woman. It's true. But that seems to be all that was necessary.
In fact, the only place where we see, in the Torah at least, where men had multiple wives, and I'm, I guess I'm looking for confirmation here, is that the cases we're talking about here where it was promoted on the part of the wives in order to have more kids. Now, as soon as I say that, I'm thinking that Esau took multiple wives.
Well, that, you see, was in response to when he had had wives already that were a bitter spirit to his parents. But then, when Asa saw that his father told him to take wives from his family, so then Asa, again, he was very desperate for his father's love and approval. So he did that himself. That wasn't because, that was a separate reason why he took on more wives. He was looking for approval, so he took wives that he felt would gain the approval of his father. And Rosora is asking one question. She's saying, have more than one wife does not go against, and they shall be one flesh. No, that's just talking about the psychological relationship, Rosora, that when a man and wife exists, so then the right union, so they become very bound up with each other. There's a strong identification, and they're complete, meaning as if they're one body, as if they're one flesh. The real state for a man and woman is that they're together, not apart. Neither one should be alone. So that they become one flesh means to say that that union then is the right state for human beings, for both genders. But that doesn't mean that there was no prohibition for Adam to have another wife. I mean, King David had more than one. There was no violation there. Yeah, but it is an interesting thing, this whole story about giving over the handmaid in order to be built up. And it seemed to be from Rashi that it was for the sake that by doing so, then they realized, Rachel and Sarah realized, again, according to Rashi, that this would give them a greater entitlement to children. And since Rachel saw that this worked by Sarah, so she did this as well. But she had to partake of that perfection. But that definitely did do something in terms of giving over her handmaid. Now, she was allowing another person to be involved at her own decision, even though her sister Leah was already married to Jacob. But this was now an act that she was doing. She didn't have anything. Well, the truth is also, there was a perfection that Rachel had, at least according to Rashi, that she gave over Leah the signs. And that's why Jacob was not, he didn't recognize it was Leah when he first got married to her. But you see that Rachel constantly rose to the occasion in terms of trying to perfect herself. And the Torah definitely, tells us when she said something that wasn't correct, when she says to Jacob, give me children. So he was, according to the commentators, responding harshly because that there's no guarantee that I can secure you children. This is something that only God can do. So it's really not in my hands. That's not the right outlook. The right outlook is that it's completely in God's hands. I believe that was also the Rashi that says, he says something very harsh. He says, Rashi on chapter 30, verse 2. Am I in God's place that I held you back from children? So Jacob says to Rachel, you say that I should do as my father, but I am not as my father. My father did not have any children, but I have children already, meaning he had children from Leah. It is from you that children are withheld, and not from me. So that sounds like he's, you know, a typical person would read that like he's rubbing her nose in it. But really Rashi is trying to tell you is that Jacob was trying to help Rachel by saying there really must be a problem here that's in you, and you should reflect and perfect yourself, because if I have children already, so really you're the one that has been withheld from having children. So he's trying to direct her that, you know, look into yourself and see what has to be corrected in order to have children. On the surface, you know, person reading it, you know, typically a person sounds like, what a callous thing to say. And this is the wife that he loved. But just the opposite, since he loved her, he wanted the best for her and focused her on the fact that you have been withholding from children, not me. So we see that Rachel immediately responded, and she said, all right, if the issue is me, and it's really I'm trying to have the child, and she overlooked the fact that Jacob already did have children, so it was more of a personal thing, so then she worked on herself to remove herself from the personal, and gave her handmaid. So you see, she worked on it right away. He pointed out the flaw, she acquiesced, and then she acted on it. Tough thing to do, but she did it.
It's interesting that they immediately kind of go to the conclusion that the fact that you can't have children suggests there is some kind of character flaw in you that you need to work on, as opposed to, that's the luck of the nature draw.
Right. Well, the Talmud in Brachas, I was just discussing this with a friend last week, it says that, you know, a person has negative things, he should reflect on himself. You don't know for sure, but they seem to be living, you're right, they seem to be living on that plane where, you know, this is the natural course of things, and if I am not having children, that means God's will must be, you know, God has held me back. I'm not sure about all the different prophecies that they had that aren't recorded. What information? But she definitely approaches Jacob first. And what was her thinking? What was Rachel's thinking? That she didn't have children, so she approaches Jacob. Why didn't she just pray to God? So perhaps she was saying that you should pray for me as well.
Seems like the first thing she would do is pray herself.
Right. Yeah, so the Ramban brings down, he says that the commentators say that Rachel was really asking Jacob to pray for her on her behalf. And maybe she felt that it had Jacob prayed for her, then she would have had children. So if she doesn't have children, she's saying, listen, you really should have been praying for me. But then Ramban says, if this is true, he says, I wonder, why was Jacob angry? Why did he say, am I in God's place? And then he says also, and is it true that the righteous people like Jacob would not pray on behalf of others? Behold, we see that Elijah prayed because of women that were not even Jewish. So you see that the righteous people do pray for others. So, well, how do we understand this case here? That Rachel is saying that Jacob should pray. What do you mean, he wasn't praying for her? So that's where he brings in what you quoted before. So God says to Jacob, this is how you answer. You answer her. By your life, your children will stand before her son, meaning Joseph. But that's a medrash. That's a metaphor. But he says, in terms of just a plain understanding of the text, so Rachel said to Jacob that you should give me children. And really what she meant was that you should, that he should pray for her until she's been given children. So that's what she was seeking out, that Jacob should pray for her until she has children. Right? And she thought that with his love for her, he should fast and dress in sackcloth and put ashes on his head and pray until he has children with her, that she shouldn't die in her pain of being barren. But then Jacob's response was back to Rachel that the prayers of the righteous is not really in their hands, that God should unconditionally always answer them. Since he saw that she was speaking with certain feminine traits, right? So he, what did he say? He got angry. Evidently, he didn't feel that it was the highest level of request, the way she was approaching it. And therefore he said that I am not in God's place, that I could promise barren women that they can have children, and then unconditionally. And therefore he said that the children have been withheld from you and not from me. And then this righteous woman, when she saw that her prayers, but she couldn't rely on the prayers of Jacob, right? The smacha tefillah of Jacob. So then she returned and started praying herself to the one who hears cries. And that's why it says afterwards that God heard her. So that's what we're saying. And Razor is saying, a possibility that Razor is writing, perhaps Rachel prayed, but nothing happened. So she thought Jacob could have had more influence on God. But that's exactly the dialogue, Razor. So Jacob is saying back, no, I have no way to guarantee you that my prayer is going to be unconditionally answered. So when she heard that, so then she realized that she just has to pray to God directly. That's it. And she can't bring Jacob into the equation because it's really her. Jacob was trying to refocus her attention on the fact that she made an error, and she wanted her husband to get involved with something, but he's saying, no, this is not in my hands. Meaning to say, it's really you. You have to reflect on yourself. It's between you and God. I'm not part of this equation. The fact that God gave me children already means to say that I don't have a flaw. There must be something in you. So that's why she returned and started praying for herself, and that's why it says afterwards that God heard her. Because now she had the right, corrected view. And then she had children. So it works out very nicely. Then once she recognized that it's really just between her and God, so it's not Jacob, so now she had to exclusively focus on her own traits. And by doing so, as she prayed to God, and recognized that it's completely between her and God, no other being is part of this equation. So then she was able to have the right approach. Let me see how he concludes over here. That seems to work. That's a good the way Ramban over there is explaining it. Right? Makes sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Rabbi. Appreciate that.
Let me ask you, did we ever do, I know that Jack Saunders had a question a month or two ago, I'm not sure if we ever did it here, you know, in the class on Sunday, regarding whether Bnei Noach were released from the laws, from the seven laws. Did we ever do that?
No. That Bnei Noach are somehow released from the seven Noahide laws?
Yeah, it's the, you take a look at Tractate of Avodah Zarah. It's 2B, and it goes up to 3A, like halfway down 3A. So it seems like on the surface, they're quoting a verse, actually, that that God released them from their seven laws. So Jack had sent me this. I never saw the Talmudic portion before, so I took a look at it and worked it out. But and I thought, did we ever do it here together? So you're saying no, so we should definitely do this.
Yeah, I don't recall that we did do that.
Okay. Let's do that as the next class then. That's towards the end of 2B in Tractate, you know, Talmud of Avodah Zarah, towards the bottom.
And that would be at cominghere.com, wouldn't it?
I'll see exactly where it starts. So I have it open right here.
Sure, Avodah Zarah is out there.
Let's see.
Looking.
Let's see.
Yes, the Avodah Zarah is out there.
Okay, good. Yeah, I have it in mind, so it's four or five lines from the bottom in the Hebrew text, the Aramaic text, I mean. So it's the second side of the very first page in Talmud of Avodah Zarah. And
it's the bottom of 2A, beginning of 2B?
No, no, the bottom of 2B, beginning of 3A. 2B to 3A. Okay, let's see where it starts.
Oh, I see it. He saw that the nations did not observe even the seven precepts which the sons of Noah had taken upon themselves, and seeing they did not observe them, he stood up and released them therefrom.
Right, there it is. So you take a look, and that goes down to 3A until... whole dialogue God has with the other nations, and he proves to them that the Jews kept the Torah.
Yeah, I'd very much like to do that section.
Okay. Right, maybe, what are your plans Thanksgiving? You going away?
Yeah, we've got some family stuff going on that day.
Okay, so we'll just do it Sunday next week. So this is what we'll do Sunday.
Okay.
Right, take a look
that
at it.
That would be great.
Yeah. Let me just see where it ends.
What Thursday ends up being presumably a holiday for all of you, but...
Is it a freebie?
Yeah, what do you all do on that day?
It's a day off. It's a four-day weekend usually, right? People don't go back to work Friday, do they?
No, not for the most part. Most everybody takes it off, I think. Do the Jewish people celebrate the Thanksgiving holiday in any way, or is it?
Yeah, I hear some people do. I hear many people do. You know, it's a, I don't think it's a religious thing, and so there's no, I don't think there's a problem with that. And let me just see here. Razor had just a few more follow-up points over here. Razor was writing, but it could not be also something related to Jacob, since he loves so much, he loved Rachel so much, and also wanted a child from her. I mean, it was a probability, and it was perhaps comprehensible. Rachel thought that. I guess, yeah, she thought that she can go to Jacob, but Jacob corrected her, Rosario. Jacob told her that if there was a wrong approach, that she should approach a human being. When she has a flaw, it's not between her and Jacob, it's between her and God. Okay, but Rezora writes at the end, yes, I understand the importance of communication directly to God. Okay.
Right. Let's just see. It actually goes to 3b at the top. So it's 2b at the bottom, all of 3a, and then a little bit of 3b at the top. So you go through the whole story there.
I'm sorry, you said through 3b?
Yeah, 3b at the top, not the whole, just the beginning of 3b.
Okay.
All right, so go through that, and this is what we'll take up next time.
Okay.
Very interesting.
Yeah, that will be good. And thank you for today. That was excellent.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
All right, so we'll pick up next week. And have a good good couple days off. Good Thanksgiving. And we'll see
you. You too.
Okay, thanks a lot.
For the week.
You too. Okay, good week to everybody. Rezora, have a good week. New York, Cal, Brian, whoever's there with you, Sean. Nice week to everybody.
Thanks so much, Rabbi. Thanks so much.
Okay, be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that'll wrap it up for today. We will continue next week. Same time, 11:15 a.m. Eastern time. Till then, everybody have a great week.